101.9 FM presents News 101, Vancouver's volunteer-produced student and community newscast. Now, here's your host, Rita Farkas.
Good evening. Coming up on the program, we speak with a UBC journalism student on the subject of police brutality. And Vanock is striving to make the 2010 Winter Olympics the greenest yet. And on commentary, Phil Caudry looks at who he feels will win the GOP for the 2008 presidency, and Trace, which candidate is most viable to keep the White House in Republican hands. We'll have all this plus arts, sports, and your weekend weather forecast coming up in the next 45 minutes right here on News 101. But first, we have a look at what's happening on campus from our friends at Radio Free UBC. This week, the group has a critical look at the AMS elections with Jasmine Ramsey and Mike Richardson.
Damn, Mike!
Okay, this is a theoretical critique of the election process. There's something to be said when out of 40,000 students, only 5 people or less run for the position of president, or VP academic, or VP external, etc. This disinterest in student government suggests that there is something profoundly alienating about the process of elections, a process that reduces people to mere voters and robs them of their productive capacity to create a better society. So there is something about the election system which reduces people to either candidates or voters that is profoundly incompatible with contemporary society. The fact that voter turnout rates are so low signifies that people are dissatisfied with the entire system of voting. Voting is a passive act. To be an active member of society, to create a meaningful polity, requires more than just ticking a name off a ballot. People are forced to choose between, as we sometimes see in elections, 2 or more idiot candidates. This isn't freedom. Choosing between menu A and menu B doesn't amount to freedom. Freedom is actively participating in the governance of society, or as the case may be here, in student society, so that, to put it in no other way, government as we know it ceases to exist. The problem with the AMS and the AMS elections is that it is the explicit decision-making body. That's right, out of 40,000 students, a couple will run for the AMS, a few thousand will vote, so that in turn, 5 executive members, i.e. 5 students, represent 40,000. The problem is, why such an elitist form of government? Why do we need 5 students to represent 40,000? And is this even possible? So to end this segment, maybe there is something about the way we conceptualize political participation that is inherently flawed.
In the final VP academic debate, Senator and Senate candidate Alfie Lee asked why, despite a campus population that is ethnically identified as 35% Asian or Asian Canadian, there's such a disparity in the representation of student government. This is a question that really points to many deeper issues on the way the AMS encourages student engagement and student participation. I think every year that I've seen debates go on and seen the election process go on, somebody brings up the issue of student apathy. And why is it that there aren't more students engaged? Why is it that only 7% of students or 10% of students are voting? And I think what often gets ignored is the really structural and fundamental reasons why students are not participating. If you look at the people who are involved in things like the AMS and like the big AMS clubs, in a lot of cases, these are people who don't have to work part-time jobs and who don't have to necessarily work incredibly hard to get scholarships. They're students that maybe are in programs like arts, which tend to be less career-oriented than things that are more time-demanding, like engineering and commerce. And so these are the people that have the time to do these things. And we need to look at the socioeconomic divisions within our society that are based on race and ethnicity. And I think that's a lot of what comes back to Alfie's question. I also think that when we talk about apathy, we're not getting at some of the really key issues, which are students aren't necessarily lazy by nature, and they're not necessarily unengaged by nature, but when students are working 20 hours a week at a job or 2 jobs, it's really hard to give a shit about AMS elections. And when students are commuting an hour to live in East Van because they can't afford housing on campus and they can't afford housing anywhere near campus, it's really hard for them to come to every debate and really give their input and run for these things. So I give great credit to Alfie for asking this question, and I just hope that in future the AMS can really address the fundamental structural racial issues that are underlying our class-based AMS.
And thanks to Radio Free UBC for that piece. There are some interesting things happening right now with the AMS elections. I don't think the results are posted yet, but there are some discrepancies with one of the categories. So stay tuned for news on that. All right. Now with a look at local news, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Leanne Yu and Marie Bernard.
Workers on a construction site in North Vancouver were disturbed this morning by the discovery of two pipe bombs in a porta potty on site. The discovery was made around 10:30 this morning when the site manager found the bombs, one constructed out of metal and the other out of plastic. As a result, a bomb-sniffing dog is now sweeping the site near Mountain and Dick Road. North Vancouver RCMP Corporal Randall Wong said he was most concerned about the mentality of the person who set out these bombs, taking the time to put the things together and then going to the trouble of taking it over to the construction site.
And a new proposal would see condos built on BC Place's parking lots in order to fund stadium renovations. The chair of BC Place, David Podmore, has asked the City of Vancouver to amend regulations and allow commercial and residential development around the Vancouver landmark. The revenue from the proposed high-rises would go to replacing the stadium's Teflon roof, which is badly in need of upgrade. The 25-year-old roof collapsed a year ago when heavy winds and rain caused a tear in its aging fabric. Podmore hopes for quick approval from the city so that the sale of condos can fund stadium upgrades before 2010, when the facility is scheduled to host the opening and closing ceremonies of the Winter Olympics.
According to the David Suzuki Foundation, the 2010 Olympic Winter Games could be one of the most climate-friendly Olympic Games in history. That's if it follows the recommendations of the Suzuki Foundation's report. Part of Vancouver's bid for the Olympics included a promise to reduce the impact of climate change. The Vice President of Sustainability for VANOC, Linda Cody, says they look forward to working with the David Suzuki Foundation and other agencies to help make the 2010 Olympics as carbon neutral as possible. The Suzuki Foundation report advises VANOC to measure and reduce greenhouse gases associated with the Games and then use carbon offsets to balance the net greenhouse gas emissions to zero. The foundation recommends that VANOC encourage everyone involved with the Olympics, including athletes, spectators, media, and sponsors, to participate in the program. They also want VANOC to account for emissions from air travel to and from Vancouver related to the Games and to use the Games as a platform to promote energy conservation and carbon neutrality to the world.
The film industry in British Columbia is giving a sigh of relief after a recent announcement from the province. Reacting to the loonie's parity with the U.S. dollar, Finance Minister Carol Taylor announced an increase in film tax credits for all new productions. The basic film incentive tax credit will increase to 35%, up from 30%, and the production services tax credit will increase to 25% from 18%. For productions outside the Greater Vancouver area, they get a credit of 12.5% as well, and a credit of 18% for digital and animated productions. Similar tax incentives for the film industry have been enacted recently in Ontario and Quebec.
A new institute to study climate change will be created at the University of Victoria, thanks to a generous grant from the province. According to Premier Gordon Campbell, the new institute, to be called the Pacific Institute for Climate Solutions, will bring together top scientists, researchers, government officials, and the private sector to develop green products for consumers worldwide and encourage greener lifestyles. It will be a collaborative effort between researchers from four of BC's universities, policymakers, and private businessmen. In addition to generating ideas about solutions to climate change, the Institute will tackle problems such as new energy systems and alternate forms of transportation. The province is giving this new institute a generous endowment, almost $100 million, so that it can continue to operate far into the future.
And garbage landfills may become a rarity in BC as Metro Vancouver officials have decided on alternative methods of waste disposal. Previous plans to build a new landfill in the province's interior were abandoned today following a Metro Board meeting. A dump site currently serves the interior at Cache Creek, a town at the junction of the Trans-Canada Highway and the Caribou Highway. The landfill is expected to run out of room in less than 2 years. Metro Vancouver's Solid Waste Committee decided it would be impossible to build a new landfill in the interior due to First Nation opposition to the site. The region is now looking at alternatives such as large-scale composting. A focus will be put on creating new incineration technology that converts household trash to energy. Meanwhile, dumping may be increased at the Delta landfill by Burns Bog. Garbage may also be shipped to Washington State until alternatives are in place. We're now going to take another break, but stay tuned. When we'll come back, we'll update you on national and international news and have an interview with a local journalism student. Stay with us. News 101 will continue right after this.
If you're interested in a wicked mix of performances all taking place in one night and locally at one place, then...
It's the fourth annual fundraiser for the North Shore Women's Center.
We're talking about an all-women's mixed program, a rare artistic collaboration of acclaimed local performers that have come together for a common cause.
Happening Saturday, February 2nd, 2008 at the Centennial Theater located at 2300 Lonsdale Avenue in North Vancouver.
Tickets available after January 24th, either in person or by phone, at the North Shore Women's Center, the Centennial Theatre Box Office, or Little Sisters. Reach us by phone at 604-984-6009.
Performances include dancing, theatre, improv, and more. Early bird tickets available.
What is that? I know what that is. That's music.
For $15, the Friends of CITR card scores you in-store discounts at Beat Street, Red Cat, Vinyl, Scratch, and Audio Pile. Support Vancouver's finest indie radio station and pick up your card today.
What do you want to do with your life?
I want to rock.
BCSportsBeat.ca is your source on the internet dedicated to providing you with information on professional and amateur sports in your province. You'll find game scores, team updates, and the perspective of the athletes through in-depth interviews all at BCSportsBeat.ca. BCSportsBeat.ca, your source for BC Sports.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Darren Fleet. He's a grad student here at UBC with the School of Journalism. Yesterday, Darren was in the downtown east side covering the visit of Governor General Mikhail Zhang, where he and others witnessed what is or what could be called an act of police brutality in the midst of the Governor General's visit. Darren, can you tell me exactly what you saw or what you witnessed last night?
What I witnessed? Well, I've kind of started to describe it in a series. Well, sorry. In an anecdotal form, so it's like, picture this. You've got Michel Jean saying that the arts can make the downtown east side a better place. You've got the police chief Jim Chu saying that acts of police brutality are extremely rare. And then you got Maestro Fresh West saying, yo. And meanwhile, outside, at least six police officers are on top of a suspect in the center of the intersection at Corral and East Hastings, and deploying a taser.
Okay, so the evening begins at the center. It's an arts forum, I believe, was the purpose of the evening.
Yeah, what Michel Jean has been doing for the last year is going to different cities and asking basically their urban youth and urban artists how urban art can help make their societies better or make their communities better.
Mm-hmm. And so this was also part of a tour where she wanted to get a better sense of some of the troubles that we're facing, particularly in the downtown east side, incorporate her visit to the women's shelter, etc. So this evening, though, was separate from that. This wasn't a forum for her to voice some of her experiences in the area.
Michelle talked a little bit about her experiences. It was actually quite interesting. So she has a speech that mm-hmm. she generally says, which is written down in press. Get a copy of it, mm-hmm. so there's nothing new. And then when she was done her speech, she actually talked personally about her events.
Okay.
Or about the things she saw. And that's, you could see the crowd really engage her mm-hmm. then, because it's kind of, she's moving outside of the message. She's actually talking from the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And then the extremely interesting thing about it is that the contrasts of the evening were incredible. Artists were standing up, talking. You have people saying, you know, they need more money for the arts, or they need et cetera, et cetera. And then one gentleman who was the first person to speak said the biggest issue that he faces in the downtown east side as both an artist and a person is mm-hmm. police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first crowd comment made in the evening.
Right.
And then so it was pretty incredible about an hour later to see six cops using a taser on a guy.
Right. So it is an interesting, I'd like to get a sense of how you feel about that. It's an interesting arena of both poverty. You're right in the heart of poverty, what we call like the national capital of poverty is in the downtown east side of Vancouver, and also art. There's a huge artist scene there. So you have this sort of relationship between the two, and then a politician there, or several politicians, I suppose, and then a bunch of journalists there. So, I mean, what does that produce? What does that...
Man, worlds were colliding all over the place. Like, right. When I first walked in, they have, like, this hip-hop dance team, and I maybe everyone else at UBC is more familiar, but I'm like, I didn't even know we had hip-hop in Vancouver. Right. All of a sudden, Maestro Fresh West is there, and, like, the you know, like, what appeared to be the entire... What do you call that dancing hip-hop people do?
Breakdancing.
Okay. I sound like I'm 90 years old. So you got that element, and then you've got politicians. You've got the head of, you've got the chief of police, interestingly speaking, on the same day that the police handed out their Beyond the Call awards for officers who have shown valor in the call of duty,
right.
And then later in that evening to have what could be construed as an incident of police brutality happen literally right in front of the Governor General. Worlds are colliding indeed.
So from your experience, is this an incident that justifies what is being called police brutality? I mean, this is only a short period away from a huge international incident using a taser gun. Does this justify more speculation and, you know, more of an outcry about whether or not these guns should be used and whether or not police are abusing their rights?
I would be interested to see what's actually in the newspapers tomorrow, if anyone follows it, you know, because I think what makes this incident sort of worse than it is that, you know, like six officers and taser. I spoke with one of the officers after the event, and the way the Vancouver police described it is basically this man was standing in the middle of the street. He almost got hit by a bus. Police approached him. He became violent or made aggressive gestures. And then they went to take him down, and it took that many officers because either he was intoxicated or on some type of drug, and it was putting up quite a fight. From my position as a viewer, I actually didn't see the event till halfway through.
Okay.
So I get out there, and the police are on top of him. The taser has been employed. Certain people in the room had a better eyesight. But the general impression amongst everybody there was shock in the fact that no matter how you kind of skew it, like, six officers on top of a guy plus a taser kind of looks like brutality. Now, whether or not it is, I don't know. I can't say that.
Mm-hmm. Now, the reports today, I read a report in the Times Colonist said that it was, this one was by the Canadian Press, that it was actually a transit police officer who ended up using a taser gun as he was conveniently passing by and managed to help out several officers who couldn't seem to subdue him. So that's an interesting issue in itself. It raises some questions about whether or not transit cops should be carrying taser guns.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that. If there's something I might add about the event, though, when you have the context of the downtown east side, and this is my conjecture, you've got people facing poverty, facing extreme addiction issues, and also mental health issues. So anytime you have officers encountering a person who's in an agitated state, the chances of it escalating are profound, and it happens very, very quickly. So that's once again why it's hard to say, you know, like you look out the window, six cops taser, that's got to be police brutality.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I actually have a lot of respect for a lot of the cops in the downtown east side. I think it's a very difficult job.
Sure.
Transit cops with tasers, I don't know.
Well, I suppose the issue of, you know, sensationalism in the media is really hot on this topic in particular here in Vancouver. I mean, we're hearing reports about lawyers in Poland getting involved in what happened at YVR. So we are sort of sensitive to this. I hope we're not sensationalizing this event. One of the other issues, that in this report I read today was that this man apparently was known to police, is a known street drug dealer. So we get all these notions of, oh, it's familiar, it's not a big deal, you know, this is no unexpected event. I guess what's interesting is the hype that it brings about, you know, can we bring politicians, high-profile politicians, to the downtown east side and have a successful meeting and have reporters like yourself observing it without creating even more hype?
Well, you know, I think it's great. And someone who was at the forum commented that they actually addressed Michel Jean when they had the microphone, or Michael Jean, sorry, and said, I want you to think about this, basically. I don't remember the exact word, but said, think about this, what you just saw, as part of this whole art form and what we're doing here, because this is the downtown East
Side.
This
is the essence of what's happening.
And then regarding the issues of tasers, like, it's supposed to be used as a, my understanding is a non-lethal option, but I think if I have the number correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, 21 people died of tasers last year. It ideally is supposed to be used as a last resort.
Anyway, that is a separate issue. Thanks for your look at it. Lastly, one of the other things that I thought was really interesting about the reports that I read was just the difficulty that our mayor, Sam Sullivan, has in appearing in the downtown East Side. Like, he is very unpopular in that area because of his work and his policies towards social housing, etc. It sounds like what her press secretary was saying, Jean's press secretary was saying, was that it was not unexpected at all, the protesting that took place. The incident with the man, that was unexpected. But because you have people like Sam Sullivan escorting her through the area and people yelling and saying, you know, this is your fault and you're like trying to erase these great programs and the Woodward's, you know, reconstruction of that. He's really changed the reconstruction of that. What do you think about the issue of a local politician being so unpopular in the area that he's spurring events like this?
You know, I actually don't know a lot about Sam Sullivan, and the issue is housing in the downtown East Side. My understanding is he got elected on some promises about housing, and some people feel those promises haven't been made. I know for a fact that homelessness has doubled in the down, at least in Vancouver, 100% from the period of 2003 to 2005, and some of that time is during his tenure. Yeah, I mean, politicians tend to be unpopular wherever they go, unless you're the governor general, who's incredibly has this persona of sweetness. But I think that's because at the end of the day, she doesn't have a lot of power for policy.
Sure, yeah, she's.
You know, people are upset. People are angry. Politicians have made promises. Sometimes they run into roadblocks they didn't see and can't fulfill. I don't know enough about Sam Sullivan's policies to comment any more than that.
Okay, well, thanks for commenting at all on the issue. It's interesting to hear a firsthand experience on it. I'm sure we will continue to read about the issue in the upcoming week, I'm sure. That's Darren Fleet. He's a student of journalism here at UBC. We're going to go now to a PSA break, and we'll be back with national and international news.
We're here to inform you about African Awareness Week happening at UBC between the dates of February 1st and February 8th.
This is a unique event with the purpose of increasing awareness about the importance of Africa studies at UBC. We will accomplish this by holding seminars, workshops, and events during that week and presenting world-class African scholars, writers, artists, and activists to carry our mission of exceeding the layperson's expectations of how much Africa has to give to the world.
All are welcomed. For more information or for details on the seminars, workshops, and events, please visit the website at www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca.
If you want to know the truth and drop a stereotypical perception of Africa, this is your chance to become an informed citizen.
www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca.
Made, student featured, UBC TV. Check out www.ubctv.ca. Originally conceived in 1990, UBC TV reinvented itself this past year with the launch of www.ubctv.ca. With support from UBC Rec and run by and for students, the site showcases student material ranging from films and music videos to sports, including the production of its own show, UBC Sports Desk. With the goal of getting students involved, UBC TV allows students to submit their content. Viewers have the added advantage of video on demand, allowing them to choose with ease exactly what they want to watch and when. UBC TV is recruiting staff for the next school year. Positions available are IT Director, Marketing Director, Program Director, Producer, Videographer, and Marketing Assistant. Anyone interested is requested to send an email to info@ubctv.ca or to log on to ubctv.ca for more details.
I want to be on your TV so that you might notice me.
February 20th, tune in all night long for the Homelessness Marathon on CITR.
Why do a nationwide homelessness marathon?
Because homeless people should have access to the media where they can freely speak out. Because it is the homeless who are best able to educate people on the issue of homelessness.
This 14-hour broadcast will begin at sunset on Wednesday, February 20th, and continue through sunrise the next day in front of the Native Friendship Center of Montreal.
This year, more than 30 stations are carrying the Homelessness Marathon. For more info, visit www.citr.ca.
To participate, dial 1-866-763-4136. Call toll-free.
They say you don't want people giving you too much?
No, well, you know what, see, like, when you panhandle, people like you to come up with some clever kind of saying. And it's really unique, because every individual's got what's going to make them laugh, and you may not even understand why they're laughing.
And the news continues on CITR. While it's not a bad thing to have more time off, Ontario employers aren't warming up to the idea of a new statutory holiday in February. With a look at that and other national stories, we're joined in studio by News 101 reporters Carrie Baptist and Megan Turcato.
Family Day will not be catching on with a majority of Ontario employers. During the 2007 provincial election, Ontario Liberals promised to create a new holiday called Family Day on February 18th. The holiday was proclaimed quickly after the government's re-election. But a survey done by the Human Resources Professionals Association of Ontario says about 40% of workers will not be given the day off. This is because 60% of employers anticipate a moderate to significant impact on their businesses due to the new holiday. But there is a silver lining for workers wishing for Family Day. 89% of employers surveyed intend to compensate their employees with an alternative that is of equal or greater benefit. This could be in the form of another day off or monetary compensation.
The federal Liberals are calling on Stephen Harper's government to launch an independent inquiry into the dismissal of National Nuclear Security Watchdog Linda Keane. Keane, responsible for blowing the whistle on the blatant safety violations of a nuclear reactor in Chalk River, Ontario, that produced isotopes for medical purposes, was fired by Natural Resources Minister Gary Lund shortly before both were set to discuss the shutdown before the House of Commons. Lund justified his decision by saying that Keane had lost the government's confidence over the way she handled the nuclear reactor case. However, the Liberals and the federal NDP both say that an independent inquiry into Keane's dismissal is necessary to make sure Lund had a just cause.
And in international news, an Afghan court sentenced a 23-year-old Afghan journalism student to death on Tuesday for printing and distributing a paper that violated the tenets of Islam. Syed Parveh Kambask was sentenced by a panel of three judges after he discussed a paper that he found on the internet with his teachers and fellow classmates at Bach University in Mazar-i-Sharif, a northern provincial capital in Afghanistan. The charges were filed in October 2007, after several of Kambask's classmates complained to police that the paper humiliated Islam. Although the student's family and several Afghan journalism associations have denounced the verdict, members of Afghan government's cleric council were pressuring the judges to pass a harsh verdict. Kambask has been in jail since the charges were filed, and he will remain there until his appeals have been heard. The case is now in the Court of Appeals, where it will stay for 2 weeks, but Bok's Chief Justice says there is not much hope for the case. Since Kambash did admit that the paper violated the tenets of Islam, only Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai can offer the student's pardon.
And it's now time for political commentary. This week, Phil Caudry discusses the GOP race for the 2008 presidency.
A couple of weeks ago, I discussed the Democratic field for the 2008 presidential election and who I felt best would be able to lead the party to victory. This week, I want to touch upon the Republican field for the 2008 election. So for all the GOP supporters listening right now, don't worry, I have not forgotten about your party, and today I will discuss who I feel is the most viable option for the GOP to take back the White House in 2008. Even after 5 primaries and caucuses, the race still remains wide open, and there is no clear frontrunner. Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney has won in Wyoming and Michigan, while Governor of Arkansas Mike Huckabee has won in Iowa. John McCain, the senator from Arizona, has won both in New Hampshire and the crucial state of South Carolina. So while these 3 candidates have won in some crucial states, they have not received the momentum that they expected. No candidate has won 2 states in a row, and this is a real reason why there has been no momentum shifting in any particular candidate's direction. As of now, any one of these 3 candidates could win the presidential nomination for the Republican Party. The indecision surrounding the GOP race has been so high that once frontrunner Fred Thompson has recently bowed out after a distant 3rd-place finish in South Carolina. In the summer, Thompson was considered the reincarnation of Ronald Reagan, an actor-turned-senator that would be able to knock away all competition in the field and bring back the Republicans to the White House. However, thanks to his lackluster campaigning and his genuine disinterest in the process, Fred Thompson has not gained the traction he needed or been able to connect with voters to secure a base. Another front-runner for the GOP, Mayor Giuliani, is in the single-digit support so far in the crucial primaries and caucuses that have taken place. He has bet his whole campaign on winning in Florida, which is to take place on January 30th. This will turn out to be a bad strategy, as Rudy Giuliani is going to lose on January 30th and will go on to have a weak performance in the February 5th primaries. As a result, the GOP is going to choose a candidate who was not considered a frontrunner initially in the race. I can only really see one of the 3 candidates who has already won a primary or caucus that is going to take this nomination. While Mitt Romney has the deep pockets needed to continue to go forward and compete in the Super Tuesday primaries, he's been unable to really connect with voters, as his consistency on key issues has been questioned. Also, in recent polls, he is considered to have the highest negatives amongst all candidates in both the Democratic and Republican Party. These kind of numbers do not reflect well upon his chances to win the presidency, and Republicans will not choose someone that they know will crash and burn in the general election. Mike Huckabee, the populist from Arkansas, who had a surprising win in Iowa, will also not have the ability to take this nomination. He does not have the financial backing or name recognition to win this race. He did not receive the flurry of campaign donations that he expected after winning in Iowa. As a result, he has been somewhat lackluster since. While Mike Huckabee's conservative values may resonate with many GOP voters, he simply does not have the ability to win this race. So that leaves Senator John McCain, the Republican who ran against George Bush in 2000 for the Republican nomination, and notorious for being a maverick and not following party lines. This has got McCain in quite a bit of trouble amongst his party base, as he called Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell agents of intolerance in the 2000 election. Calling religious leaders terms like that is not going to make you popular amongst GOP voters. However, ironically, what's isolating McCain most from GOP voters is his consistent stance on the war in Iraq and his unrelenting support for George W. Bush. Most Republicans want to distance themselves from the now unpopular president. However, McCain embraces him and his policy, and as a result, is alienating GOP voters. But in a race where good candidates have come few and far between for the GOP, they may have to hold their nose and vote for John McCain, as they know that he has the best chance of beating Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama in the general election. In polls, John McCain has a narrow lead over both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. With McCain's ability to attract Democrats and independents, and a positive personal character built around his wartime stories, a maverick image, McCain may be the only thing the GOP has against the Democrats. If I were to give one piece of advice for GOP voters, it would be think pragmatically in this election. Your party is not liked. Americans are sick and tired of the Republicans in the White House, and the only chance you have, the only slim chance that you have of getting back into power is with John McCain. He has consistently been able to attract Democrats and independents, and his record in the Senate is consistent with his views. These kind of candidates are hard to come by. You should consider yourself lucky that you have McCain on your side during this time. For News 101 Commentary, I'm Phil Caudry.
And thanks, as always, to Phil for that piece. All right, break time again, but coming up next is the Arts Report with Katie Fitzpatrick. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Dance, Papa. Oh, can't we see the pretty horses?
Yes, on February 8th.
Oh, but do tell me where, Papa.
CITR's party celebration, being held at the Sub at UBC, 7 p.m. in the evening.
May we dress up?
Oh, but of course. You may dress up as your favorite dead trend. It's the theme.
Oh, will there be a small prize for the best costumes?
Yes, there will, little one.
19 plus.
Refreshments available.
Room 216.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR. I'm Rita Farkas, coming to you live from the Student Union Building at UEC. Thanks for being with us tonight. Right now, it's 5:40 and time to turn things over to Katie Fitzpatrick for a look at the arts.
Hello and welcome to your 5-Minute Arts Beat here on News 101. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. Now, the big news, of course, this week is the Push Festival, which opened on January 16th and is going on to February 3rd. I've had a chance to be involved in a lot of the Push Festival events that are going on. I got to see the Black Rider on its debut night, January 16th, which, of course, was also the opening date of the Push Festival. And on last Tuesday's Arts Express, I got a chance to talk to the star of that show and the artistic producer of November Theatre, which produces the show, Michael Scholar Jr. He was with me in studio on Arts Express, and you can find that at citr.ca in the podcast. And I also got a chance to see Frankenstein, which I did a review of during last week's show. My arts volunteers have been out seeing the Four Horsemen, the Misfit, an old Goryeo, all parts of the Push Festival as well. And coming up on next week's Arts Express, we're going to have another review from the Push Festival of the dance performance going on here at UBC at the Frederick Wood Theatre called Hey Girl. And actually next week on News 101, we're going to be reviewing the 20-something theatre production of Fever, a group that always does some great productions. I saw another one of theirs earlier this year. So there's lots of great reviews to tune into, and there's also, of course, lots of great shows to check out. Now, some of the events that are going on with the Push Festival. One that's interesting is called My Name is Rachel Corey. It's showing at the Havana Theatre, the great restaurant, gallery, and theatre on Commercial Drive, from January 24th to February 2nd. Now, the story behind this is that in March 2003, 23-year-old Rachel Corey of Olympia, Washington, was crushed to death by an Israeli Defense Forces bulldozer in the Gaza Strip. A volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement, Corey was protesting the destruction of Palestinian homes. With the permission of the Corey family, actor Alan Rickman and Guardian journalist Catherine Vinner assessed Rachel Corey's diaries and emails and edited a huge volume of written material into a 70-minute, one-woman show. Once again, that's on at the Havana Theatre till February 2nd. It's called My Name is Rachel Corey. Another interesting piece going on at the Push Festival is called My Dad, My Dog. My Dad, My Dog is a hilarious and beautiful, honest account of a young woman who is convinced that her father has returned to her, reincarnated as her pet dog. That one is showing at the Roundhouse Community Arts and Recreation Center, January 25th to 26th, and January 29th to February 2nd. Another one that I find quite interesting is Clark and I Somewhere in Connecticut. In the summer of 2005, actor-writer James Long salvaged a collection of 7 photo albums and travel journals from an alley near his East Vancouver home. The collection, complete with detailed captions and letters, documents a family's history between 1950 and 1987, and includes everything from birth notices to a full eulogy for the archivist Pomeranian, Mandy. In the fall of 2007, a team of collaborators went in search of the origins of these books and ran into multiple questions surrounding the legality and morality of working with found materials. What started as a simple trip to the country carried the creators on narrative jags across propriety, oceans, and beyond. That is at Performance Works. Once again, it's called Clark and I Somewhere in Connecticut. And it's on from January 30th to February 2nd, the kind of project that I think I would love to do if I came across albums such as those. Some other events that are coming up this week include Glow from Melbourne, Chunky Move artistic director Gideon Obersanek, and German interactive software engineer Frieder Weeb have together created an intimate interactive solo performance in which the motion of the human body is used to trigger and control music, lighting, and animation. A digital landscape is generated in real time in response to the dancer's movement, with the body gestures extended by and in turn manipulating the surrounding video world. That's at the Scotiabank Dance Center, January 31st to February 2nd, an interesting mix of dance with modern technology. Another event currently from here from the Push Festival, but coming from Australia, is Small Metal Objects. An ingenious theatrical gem, Small Metal Objects unfolds amid the high-volume pedestrian traffic. against the backdrop of the metropolis. On a raised seating bank with individual sets of headphones, the audience is wired into an intensely personal drama being played out somewhere in the crowd. That's January 30th to February 1st at the Vancouver Public Library, the Central Branch at Promenade. If you're interested in any of those Push Festival events I mentioned, you can go to www.pushfestival.ca. I think a lot of the tickets are already almost sold out, but it's worth checking out to see if there's anything you can still go see. A lot of great events, and not all of them are going to be getting as much attention as others, and I'm sure that most of them are very worthy of checking out. So go to the website, find out more about that, and be sure to tune into the upcoming weeks of Arts Express. We're going to be shifting gear from the professionals down to the students now. We're going to be talking to some students from Emily Carr, from UBC Theatre, and possibly from the music department to find out about what it's like to be up and coming in the Vancouver art scene. Once again, for News 101, I'm Katie Fitzpatrick.
And thanks for that, Katie. Before we go tonight, we'll check in with meteorologist Selena Ferris for a look at your weekend weather. Selena.
It looks like we're about to see the end of all this sunshine. The current high pressure is breaking up as a storm moves in over the region. Tomorrow morning, the clouds will be moving in, and there will be rain with snow for higher elevations in the afternoon, with a high of 3 degrees. Sunday, we'll see a mix of snow and rain, on and off throughout the day, with a high of 2 degrees. Early next week, we will see much of the same conditions. That's your weekend weather, live from Mount Seymour, brought to you by the Storm Club at UBC. For more information, you can email us at stormubc@gmail.com.
And thanks for that, Selena. That's our very own in-house meteorologist, and that's pretty interesting to know she was live from Seymour Mountain. That's our program for January 25th, 2008. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, give us a hot news tip, or get involved with the show, contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email news@citr.ca. Tracy Fuller produced this radio program. For more news, join us Monday at 5 p.m. for the next edition of News 101. For the entire news team here at CITR, I'm Rita Farkas. Thanks for listening. Coming up next, Thunderbird Eye on Sports with Jeff Sargent. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.